Welcome to WOB Radio, and today we are going to be singing you a song from the Little Red Songbook, There Is Power in a Union, the Billy Bragg version.
You can sing along if you want.
If you have the IWW's Little Red Songbook, you can find it on the IWW store online.
There's power in the factory, power in the land, power in the hands of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past we all learn with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud, war has always been the boss's way, sir. The Union forever defending our rights. Down with the Black Lake, all workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters in many far-off lands, there is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that they realize brutality and unjust laws can't beat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone? What a comfort to the widow, a light to the child. There is power in a union.
Welcome one, welcome all to WOB Radio. We are broadcasting from KTAH 101.9 FM, KTQA in Hilltop, and KZAX in Bellingham. This is a production of the Industrial Workers of the World. We are an industrial union of all trades. My name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns, and I've been in the IWW since March of 2021. And if you want to go around the circle.
Sure. I'm Marilyn, and I use she, they pronouns. I've been a member since at least 2006, maybe before, and I'll pass it to my left, my right, and this is...
Alan. I joined in 71 or 72, dropped out many times, came back several times, so I'm still here.
Yeah.
And he, him.
Alrighty.
I'm Lynn, and I go by she, her, and I joined the IWW in Tacoma in, I believe it was 2007. You're going to wonder about all of us and our memories. None of us is sure of the year. But anyway, and then I continued again after not being active for a few years in about 2018, 19, something like that. More confusion. And that's it. Next person.
My name is fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a retired shipyard worker. From Bremerton. I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, and I have been since 2008.
Thank you so much.
That was well done, Gordon. And you guys always remind me that I forget to give what profession I was in, and I think it might
thought
be...
Thought about that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Why don't we go ahead and start off?
Yeah. So I'm a former mental health therapist working with community mental health.
Mm-hmm. I'm a retired nurse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a retired social worker and medical interpreter.
I retired as an outside machinist, which means one of the people who install the machinery aboard United States naval ships.
Nice. And I am previously in the warehousing industry, but I am currently moving on to the environmental sciences. I'm going to be working in the chemical industry. So to read you a section of the preamble of the IWW, our constitution of the IWW, I should say, to give you a bit of a background about who we are and what we believe in. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed, and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. And now, beginning our radio show today, we're going to be starting off with some updates on organized labor-related news. Our first headline is coming right out of Puyallup. The Good Samaritan nurses in Puyallup have reached a deal to avert a potential strike. This headline is coming out of a website called The Stand, news about working people standing together in Washington State. And this is according to the Washington State Nurses Association from Twitter. In the early hours of Thursday morning, MultiCare Good Samaritan nurses in Puyallup, Washington, represented by Washington State Nurses Association, reached a tentative agreement with the hospital. There will be more details coming further. From the Washington State Nurses Association, this is an extension of that quote. After 20 hours of bargaining, the nurses at Good Sam reached a tentative agreement around 4:30 a.m. If ratified, they will be getting a 12-24% raise, ratification bonuses of $3,500, dedicated break nurses, a charge nurse, and a flex nurse for each unit, and they will be getting staffing plans that cannot be rejected. The ratification vote for the union will begin June 29th. So to give some context to the listener, when a union and an employer reach a contract agreement, the contract then has to go to the unionized workers to vote on whether or not to ratify that agreement. So the union negotiators and the business made a deal. Now the union workers actually have to vote through the union as to whether or not they agree with this contract setup. So the strike has been averted for now. It's not entirely off the table as to whether or not the Good Sam nurses will strike, but it did prevent them from striking earlier this year. And so hopefully these contract negotiations will follow through. By the sound of it, these nurses have a pretty good contract that they've been offered. I mean, a 12 to 24% raise would be pretty significant for healthcare workers.
But the most important part is all those staffing positions. They need a flex person to fill in when there's vacations or illness, that kind of thing. It sounds like there's a lot of good staffing stuff that went on with that offer.
Yeah. I mean, my very good friend and roommate who actually did work at Good Sam for, I think, almost a couple years, he definitely talked about how, in his experience doing nursing during school and after school, the ratio of nurses to patients has gotten to a pretty dangerous level, even in smaller hospitals. Usually the typical staffing ratio is like one nurse to three patients is kind of the ideal. Right now, they're kind of looking at a situation where it's one nurse to five or six patients in some places.
Do you have an idea, Al, in your career, what the average was or what?
Nope. Sorry, but no.
Just wondering.
I never worked at a real hospital, so. Mm-hmm.
But you worked at Western State.
You call that a hospital?
Well, no, but I'm curious as to what the nursing ratio was at Western State.
Well, in my unit, it was one RN, two LPNs.
For how?
30, 40, 50 people. I don't know. 30, 40?
Mm-hmm.
In our unit, yeah.
Yeah.
But we didn't deliver nursing care.
Well, some of the people that were at Western State, in addition to mental illness, were probably also medically fragile.
Sure, and they shipped them out from somewhere else because they didn't keep them in our unit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We weren't prepared for that.
But in terms of the nursing staffing, staff ratio for patients and nurses, with the ratio that it's currently at, about five or six patients to a nurse, especially in the more moderate care and intensive care units, that can lead to a potentially dangerous situation where, like this contract is hoping to get, there could be a flex nurse and a charge nurse to where there is flexible coverage so that even with the staffing ratios the way that they are, there is still staff on hand to fill in the gaps wherever they're needed. You know, somebody codes or somebody needs to be transferred to a different department.
Right.
Somebody can help out with that.
If somebody is in the hospital and there's one nurse for five or six patients,
mm-hmm.
and two go into a life-threatening situation at the same time. That's dangerous. Somebody could die.
Right. So hopefully the Good Samaritan nurses will ratify this contract, or if not, they will be able to get more from their employer in terms of increasing the staffing ratio to where they can bring it down to 4 to 3 nurses for every patient, or potentially even larger raises. So everything is still up in the air right now. An offer has been made. Hopefully the nurses will agree with it. Yes? And apologies to the listeners. To clarify my previous statement, what I meant is hopefully the nurses can negotiate for a contract where there can be one nurse for every 3 to 4 patients. I believe I accidentally flipped those numbers previously. So another labor news article that we wanted to cover this month is to talk more about the current writer strike going down in California. It's been going on now for almost a couple months at this point. This is out of NPR. Not coming to a screen near you, viewers will soon feel the effect of the writer strike. And this article goes into detail specifically about how a lot of major production companies, especially down in California, are looking more towards either getting scab writers to write for the writers while they're on strike, or, as has been more widely discussed, having AI write story ideas and scripts. I believe that there is a show coming out soon that was actually entirely written by AI, the name of which I can't remember. But it does pose a very interesting question because, and this is more a technology-focused discussion that's currently going on, specifically with replacing striking workers with a form of technology that is still very much in its testing and production phase. It will be interesting to see what the future of that would look like. But in terms of the writer's strike, they are basically, these production companies are looking for ways to try and break the strike by basically using AI to produce the shows that human beings used to produce.
So it's not just California, it's the New York and other mm-hmm. locations. Okay, because earlier I thought you had said that. Anyway, but yeah, primarily.
Yeah.
So the plays and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, writers for plays, yeah, television.
I thought so.
Movies, yeah. Streaming services, things
radio
like that.
Radio shows.
Mm-hmm. Just to give a quote from this article, this week, leaders of the other major Hollywood union, SAG-AFTRA, which represents actors and other performers, try to assure members that their contract negotiations with the AMPTP were going well. Almost immediately, more than 300 actors, including Meryl Streep, Jennifer Lawrence, and Quinta Brunson, sent a letter to their union saying they're ready to strike for the best deal possible. Their current contract ends Friday, and this article was posted on June 28th. And members have already overwhelmingly voted to authorize a strike. Many of NPR's employees are members of SAG-AFTRA. Broadcast members are covered by a different contract than TV/theatrical members, though. So NPR writers organized through SAG-AFTRA won't be on strike if one is called and our own contract is not affected by these negotiations. Interesting little interjection by NPR there. Our workers are organized through SAG-AFTRA, but we have a different contract, so they're not going to go on strike, which, you know, here in the IWW, we've talked about the banning of secondary strikes and solidarity strikes and stuff like that. So I find that to be an interesting addition to the article.
And why NPR writers, I wonder? Why are they exempted?
I imagine they probably negotiated through a different union local, so they probably have a slightly different contract to a lot of these other SAG-AFTRA locals that have organized with groups like Paramount, Warner Brothers, things like that. That's why there's so many on strike. The contracts cover so many workers that when negotiations break down, it's thousands of people on the picket line. Whereas for a smaller local, maybe like through what NPR is organized through, the contract is more specific to that group of workers, and they haven't had any contract negotiations recently.
So it can't be union-wide or even, you know, inter-union because of the way the labor law is written.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Once again, works against us.
Good old Taft-Hartley.
Yeah.
A bigger piece of labor news, though, and this was one that I almost accidentally started when I meant to be talking about the writer's strike. This is coming from Mother Jones. The UPS strike is still very much potentially looming. Actually, as of the past week, several UPS locations have already started going on strike. This is coming from Mother Jones once again. July 1st, 2023, despite progress, Teamsters say UPS strike is still possible. More than 340,000 workers could potentially walk off the job. To give a quote from this article, on Saturday afternoon, Teamsters President Sean O'Brien delivered an update on the UPS contract negotiations that could lead to the company's workers striking this month in July. O'Brien stressed at a press conference that if UPS doesn't concede to the union's demands, we will put 340,000 strong Teamsters on the streets until we get what we want. The two sides have been bargaining since May, O'Brien said, adding that the union has only made gains and offered no concessions during that period. The potential to strike is a huge bargaining chip for UPS workers, whose demands include higher wages and the elimination of a two-tier driver system that Teamsters say allows some drivers to be paid less than others who are doing essentially the same work.
Yep.
The starting pay for part-time warehouse workers, who account for roughly half of UPS workers represented by the Teamsters, is $15.50 an hour at time of writing. So this is probably one of the largest potential strikes in recent history that could be happening this month. Today is the 8th as our day of recording, and it would affect a huge, huge amount of the industry in this country. I mean, you can imagine the businesses that UPS supports just by its existence.
We also have things happening with the railroads continually. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Amazon workers.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking at a storm, and I eliminated the first word I was going to say about the storm,
mm-hmm.
of distribution backups, which I have to say, although that it's inconvenient for us as consumers, it's an effective way for people to organize. And
absolutely.
We need to be, if it's not life-threatening, to absolutely support these workers that are working to gain human rights, mm-hmm. human rights, worker rights.
I would imagine that the leadership of the Teamsters who are representing the UPS delivery personnel will more than likely probably make exceptions for things like medicines through the mail or something that's vital. Like we've had general strikes in this country before. Mm-hmm. There was one in Tacoma, one in Seattle. Same
but
strike,
you know,
actually.
Because you have some confidentiality and rights to anonymity mm-hmm. in the mail, and UPS delivers a lot of mail, they may not know whether they're delivering medications.
Yeah,
that's
to
what
make
I'm
a
thinking.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It comes from in a bag with the hospital's name on it. You're pretty sure it's...
If it
rattles, it's probably important.
Yeah, probably, but if it's not life-threatening, I think we really need to lend our solidarity to these struggles.
Absolutely.
I mean, if it's just a matter of getting, you know, your favorite fruit in the grocery store, that's one thing.
Or an entire furniture set.
What? Yeah. No more avocado toast?
No more avocado toast,
yeah. Or an entire furniture set if they're shipping that. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that's so interesting about the organizing, as you've said, through a lot of transportation infrastructure, mm-hmm. whether it's the railroads or it's UPS or, you know, even the Postal Service, the National Postal Service, it makes you really realize how all interconnected these industries are, because mm-hmm. one industry can't function unless the other industry is still functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, UPS really did go on strike and 340,000 workers walked off the job, there's not going to be enough people to replace them during that strike.
No.
It would significantly affect the economy and probably bring about an even swifter conclusion. The last time...
Wait a minute. Unless Biden makes them go back to work.
Yeah.
That's the other
railroad workers.
Do you think he'll make the same mistake twice? Maybe.
He already has.
Yeah.
It's not the
first
one.
Yeah. I think that waiting for the federal government or even waiting for state and local governments to fight on the behalf of the workers is, I think, beyond the question.
Mm-hmm.
There could be a situation, especially with a strike this large, because the rail workers is only going to affect what? 60,000 workers, I think, at best, and Congress was very quick to act and cut that
mm-hmm.
off. This is 340,000.
Yeah, but the ripple effect, for instance, when the ILWU shut down, very recently, mm-hmm. shut down several ports on the West Coast, to include Tacoma. And we didn't see a lot of that in the news. Mm-mm. Because the ramifications of that is that you shut a port down, that means nothing comes in or goes out. And so there is nothing to deliver through your package service or the mail. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the interconnectedness, which is why the Taft-Hartley Act is so carefully crafted and has been since 1947 to prevent solidarity strikes, secondary boycotts, and all the other things that make the labor movement effective.
Absolutely.
You want to talk a little bit more about that, the Taft-Hartley Act, and exactly what it said?
Well, it's a pretty... It's still in force.
But is it used?
Yeah.
All the time. All the time.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was thinking, never edit that out.
No, go ahead. Start fresh, Gordon.
Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947, named after the two legislators who sponsored it. And what it effectively did is hollow out the act that came before that, which is the National Labor Relations Act, or NLRA, called the Wagner Act at the time. Which gave all these rights for unions to organize, workers to organize into unions or into other concerted activity, as they call it. Taft-Hartley gutted that.
But didn't it happen because of a historical event?
Oh, I'm not certain of that, fellow worker.
That didn't follow something like McKinley's assassination?
Oh, no, McKinley, it was way back at the beginning of the...
We're talking the 1947.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
See? Even IWW members can be ignorant, and I'm one of those. Go ahead.
Well, I'm pretty much done, except to say that it has hamstrung the labor movement, and the AFL-CIO has never effectively fielded some kind of opposition to it, because it benefits the member unions of the AFL-CIO, which is the American Separation of Labor, which keeps all these unions and all these even non-unionized workers separate from each other. Not able to support each other legally. There's ways to get around it. There's other little pressure techniques that we can use. But legally, if you read that act, it shows you that they went back on their word to the NLRA and effectively has crippled the labor movement for, 70 years?
Question, Gordon. Now, when Jobs with Justice was going strong, we used to do something called informational picketing.
That's allowed. That is allowed.
Okay.
And which means effectively and IWWs frequently do this. We go out and support
other people's struggles.
Yes.
With an informational picket.
Right.
And that is not illegal.
It's not illegal.
Which means your body is there and you may have a sign there, but you're handing out flyers.
Mm-hmm.
You're handing out information.
Mm-hmm. And that is called protected concerted activity.
Yeah.
We can support other unions. And believe me, I don't think I've ever been turned away from a picket line that I showed up to for another union. They welcome us. They welcome support. There are little particular portions of the law that could prevent, for instance, us showing up with a sign that says IWW. Okay. We can bring our flags and banners and stuff, but the picket signs themselves have to be sponsored by the striking union. It's very particular and it's vague, but a good labor lawyer can get us out of it if we get in trouble.
Well, and speaking of informational pickets, I was doing a little research for this program today, and there's a train car manufacturing company in Montana.
Okay.
That is basically doing informational picketing, striking, in air quotes, because they have issues that they want to have addressed with their bosses.
Mm-hmm.
So,
informational picketing and demonstrations of that kind are allowed under the law.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. No, I've also done a bit of a deep dive on Taft-Hartley myself. I am kind of a novice labor historian and labor law investigator myself, kind of in my own free time for my own interest, and I can definitely say that Gordon is speaking facts. Taft-Hartley has completely defanged the labor movement. I know a lot of people like to point to the 70s and 80s when union membership dropped off as kind of the low point for the labor movement in the United States, but it really started with Taft-Hartley. That laid the groundwork of employers being able to repress organizing activity, even the AFL-CIO didn't really do that much to speak out against it. It was a very widely supported bipartisan bill in politics because they recognized that quote-unquote economic benefit that would come out of this bill. So
usurping of power.
Pretty much.
Exactly.
Usurping of what was essentially a growing workers' power movement back into something that was more controllable from a political and economic standpoint.
So this started in 1947 with Taft-Hartley, and I have to tell you that a few years later, in 1954, and we were discussing this before the program, there was the almost forced merger of the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Mm. The CIO organized like the IWW does, horizontally and industrially. We don't care about your trade or craft. If you're in an industry, and we always use like aircraft industry or airline industry as an example, you know, your pilots, your baggage handlers, your flight attendants, your mechanics are all in the same union under our model of organizing. And what happened is that the AFL-CIO merged. A lot of people say AFL-CIO because it rolls off the tongue, but the CIO was a separate organization. And to merge with the AFL, they had to fire or purge all their left-wing leadership.
What?
All the communists and socialists and anarchists who were involved in the labor movement back in the day, they had to leave.
I hope they ran to the IWW.
No,
I didn't. I'm sorry. There's a point to that, which we'll get to later.
Yeah.
The IWW was in an interesting situation in the 50s, to say the least.
And I have a comment, which... You're talking about a deep dive into labor history?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, listener, this is Al, and he's quiet a lot, but here he is.
Now I forgot what I was going to say. Taft-Hartley, shallow dive. The Pittston mining strike.
Oh, yeah.
Someone said, Taft-Hartley, huh? Taft can mine it, and Hartley can haul it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Without the workers, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
There are workarounds, but the principal... barrier, the principal obstacle to working class unity, working class solidarity, are the trade unions pitting their leadership against other trade unions and taking the bread out of the mouths of other workers. It's happened as recently as 2011. I went down to Longview to walk in an ILWU picket line down there about the grain port. And while they were out, another union in the AFL, CIO, offered to do their jobs for them. Oh, yeah. They were going to scab on them. I'm not going to mention the other union because sometimes they're pretty right on. But this is a common practice within the AFL-CIO is to scab on each other.
Mm-hmm. In jurisdictional pickets is exactly how it's also described. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a book called Blood in the Water, which was about a jurisdictional dispute in the late 40s between the IAM, the Machinists Union, and the Teamsters, and it was at Boeing, and that's what, hence the title of the book. It got pretty rough.
Yeah.
Wow.
As for the upcoming UPS strike, the threat of this strike is still definitely looming. As for whether or not Congress will intervene, as to whether or not the strike is even going to happen in the first place, like UPS has said through their, like the union has said, the Teamsters Union has said through their negotiators, things have been going really well. There hasn't been any concessions to the employer.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like things are leaning towards a more positive pro-worker contract outcome. But 340,000 workers is not something to laugh at.
Right.
I think if that strike went through, the ramifications for organized labor, as well as the transportation industry as a whole, would be wild. I can't even begin to describe how much power and how much solidarity I think that would build for those workers.
Thank goodness for the younger workers today, mm-hmm. like the people who are organizing back east into Amazon Labor Union. Mm-hmm. That young person, Chris Smalls, has been pivotal in reigniting the spirit of labor solidarity. And a lot of these older unions with older leadership still kind of, you know, working the pork barrel angle of it, they're beginning to wake up and take notice. They're retiring out of the system, and we've got these young people coming up who are just refiring the imagination.
Yeah. You know, it was actually, that reminds me of something that we played in our last episode from, it was...
Ralph Chaplin.
Ralph Chaplin said that the beginning of the labor movement was with the youth.
That's right.
Young people who were easily exploitable, who were willing to work long hours for little pay, who eventually woke up and started organizing to get better pay, better workplace safety, things like that. And I think in terms of, I mean, a lot of these warehouse workers, myself included up until recently, you know, there's a lot of us who are younger, sometimes in our teens, but a lot of us in our 20s and 30s, and we're kind of looking around going, well, we're not going to buy a house anytime soon. I can't afford to get in a car accident or get a significant medical bill,
right?
You know, and so I think a lot of that revitalization of the labor movement has come from the youth learning the lessons of the past from the older organized workers who are still there to share their lessons as well.
Agreed. And a lot of the backlash or friction, intergenerational friction, where, you know, okay, boomer, you've got a pension, I don't, you know, that means you're a POS and I don't even want to talk to you. Well, that stuff is sort of falling away because now the younger workers are realizing that, geez, 50, 60, 70 years ago, when the conditions for us stupid boomers were bad, strong organizing helped solve their problem. And I think they've taken note. And I hope that the older folks can support the younger folks in their struggle. You notice that when we introduced ourselves, most of us around the table are retired. We have a young worker here sitting with us who knows the reality of the situation. And we're looking forward to working with the entire working class.
While we're talking about younger workers, I'd like to add this. They just discovered, again, there are children.
Oh, God.
Cleaning abattoirs, a fancy French word for a slaughterhouse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They do it at night. Now, I don't know when these kids go to sleep. They go home and go to sleep, or they go to school and fall asleep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But their childhoods are being stolen from them.
Right.
To make rich, greedy guys richer and even greedier.
You know, actually, on that note, considering that we're coming to the end of the labor news discussion section, do we want to jump into the roundtable?
I think we're already in it.
All right. Well, speaking of which, the next section that we had planned for you, fellow listeners, that we've kind of just organically slipped into here, we wanted to talk a little bit more about this kind of quote-unquote intergenerational struggle between younger workers who are frustrated at older workers for not doing enough in their time to do things related to environmental protections, union organizing, things like that. And anyways, let's continue the conversation, I guess.
Well, I thought we were going to do that next time, but I'm really glad to do that this time. I will jump in.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I hear old people,
mm-hmm.
and I'm one of them, but I don't say this,
mm-hmm.
but I hear quite a few old people make disparaging comments about younger people coming up, that they're ignorant, that they're spoiled, and that they have no patience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what young people they're seeing, because I find, and I know a lot of young people through 350 Tacoma, through Tacoma DSA, that's Democratic Socialists of America, and through other works, groups that I belong to, that just astound me. They are so articulate. They are so able, when they have a question, to do their own research and come up with information, much more able to do that than I am. They are very committed, and they've got the energy. And when they open their mouths, it's astonishing what comes out of their mouths. It's articulate. It's well put together. It's well researched. And they're dogged in pursuing their goals. So I don't know if there, maybe there is a split between young people that don't give a damn, excuse me, and young people that are fully committed. But I know a lot of fully committed young people, and I'm in awe of them.
Plus, they're the only folks who can figure out my telephone for me.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Well, I mean, but you're not really part of the, you know, I mean, in general, most people wouldn't run into these particular young people, I think, because you're involved in the kinds of things, and they're involved in certain things where they, by definition, care about
the issues.
Yeah. I'd actually like to interject on this on 2 points. You know, I was having a similar conversation with my family recently for Father's Day. I was sitting down with my dad, my brother's fiance, and I, and we were talking about thing, just a very long conversation about like housing prices and the cost of living and like the different, the generational differences between like attitudes towards work and why people can't start families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm the little lefty at the table and sometimes I'm a bit hesitant to open my mouth even about that kind of stuff. But, it's very interesting because they were constantly talking about generational differences in terms of like social and cultural context, which I think there's some validity to that. I mean, there was a different working culture at the time. There was a different culture and attitude around things like going to college and career growth and stuff and what kind of payoff was expected for you. But the one thing that they never really touched on that I would occasionally interject on is that the economics of today's situation are very different. Like others far more intelligible than I have described before, people are getting compensated less despite the fact that they are more productive than at any point in this country's history, and they're still getting underpaid, and the benefits are still bare bone, and their ability to organize has still been just as restrictive as it has been since Taft-Hartley or even the 80s during the Reaganomics era.
And the social contract has been broken.
Yes, the social contract of responsibility of passing on something good to the next generation, I can definitely say
or
that as well.
Or the social contract of if you get hired by this company, you will have benefits and you can work with them for life and you will have a pension.
Yes.
Definitely. Sorry.
Oh no, don't get me wrong. The younger folks have already laughed that joke to death. But the other point that I wanted to bring up is that, and it was something that you had mentioned for fellow worker Marilyn, it was something specifically relating to the fact that I think that there is, for younger people, and I've noticed this sometimes even in myself, I think that this stereotype of the kids just don't want to work anymore is a little bit true.
Yeah.
But I think the reason for it is reasonable because we don't see the reward for hard work anymore. You know, somebody my age back in, you know, the 1960s or the 50s or even sometimes into the early 70s, and for a lot of people within my particular socioeconomic strata, I have a college degree, I have a certificate, I have, you know, that whole educational experience, I have 5 years of work experience working in a variety of blue-collar fields, some of them organized, some not. By this point, at any point of those decades, I could have been able to have lived in a single-family home. I, like you said, I would have been able to retire with a pension, I would have had a retirement fund that was adequate for me to live in the first place. So I think that there is a very real notion that when the younger folks look around at the working world and they say, well, what's the point of working hard if there's not going to be any reward for it? The phrase that we have for it now or nowadays is, you know, if we're not going to get compensated, we might as well act our wage. If you're only getting paid $15.50 an hour, we're going to follow our exact job description to the letter and we're going to do nothing more.
Work to rule.
Yeah, it's basically a very round, coming full circle version of working to rule. Mm-hmm. The employers like to call it, quote unquote, quiet quitting because they think that they can put more expectations onto their younger workers, you know, carrot and stick style. If you just work a little bit harder and you take on a little bit more responsibility, if you really excel above all the others, then you'll get your reward. Then
you
you'll get
really
the retirement.
If you really want to mess somebody up, make a middle management.
Yes. I have dealt with a lot of middle managers.
Oh, you're not paid by the hour anymore. You're on contract. You're going to work more hours for the same money.
Yeah. I mean, especially now in the tech industry with things like gaming and AI development and software programming, that kind of salaried exploitation, especially in the gaming industry, I could go into a whole rabbit hole about that, but for the sake of brevity, I won't, you know. Kind of coming back to the original point of my conversation, there is a generational difference, but the one thing that I say whenever I hear this discussion, whether it's with older folks or younger folks, is, are we being more or less exploited than the people before us?
Because I think
we have this very idealized image that, oh, the baby boomers had it so good. They grew up at a time when there was more union concentration and their wages that they were earning were able to match the cost of living better.
A high school graduate could make a career without a college degree.
Absolutely, which is true.
Still possible.
But they were still being exploited.
Sure.
And this is where I think the class conscious part of it becomes really important, that even if there was a wider margin of people who could graduate with a high school or college degree and live in a single family home, these people were trying to get screwed over by their boss. Well, the bosses were trying to screw over these workers just as hard as they are now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now they just have a different playbook. They've tried to soften the club, so to speak.
Other methods, too, of enslaving. And what I've noticed is the whole bill of goods that young people have been sold for at least 20 years, which is that you get a four-year college degree, you're going to be so far ahead of the people who just decided to go into the military or, you know, go into an apprenticeship to get a skill, that you're going to be way far ahead of them. And with $30,000-$40,000 in student debt that you can't even bankrupt out of, thank you, GOP, for mm-hmm. changing the bankruptcy laws, these young people are stuck in enslavement of a certain kind. They got to pay these college degrees, these educations off. I screwed up. I could have gone to college in New York, City College, for zero. I could have gone to Brooklyn College, Queens College. I could have gone to a couple of state universities for nothing. I got drafted instead. That's another story. But what I'm getting at is that they've been enslaved. I don't know when this whole student loan thing really got off the ground, but I remember taking a year of college, community college in Bremerton, on the government's dime. They had a program that accidentally got passed, and they gave a geezer veteran some money to go to college. And when I was there, I was with 20-somethings and even younger people, people in the accelerated program, they call it Running Start, right, where you can take your college 101 courses while you're still in high school. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting next to 18-year-olds and 25-year-olds, and they're looking at me sideways, and I'm looking at them sideways. And yet we found out a lot of things in common and developed a lot of respect and developed... I got culturally educated, so it was a good experience. And I think the more of that work that we do, the more, for instance, you participating in Sunshine stuff, you participating...
Sunrise.
These generationally young people's movements, right? Mm-hmm. You learn something, and they probably learn something, too.
Well, it's interesting. No, I have some sad feelings about that, but I did learn some things. I was basically... told that us old people messed up the world and that now it was their time and we needed to listen to them and they didn't need to listen to us. And I felt pretty rejected.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Because you're...
But there's an element of truth in what they said.
I agree. And it's our job, really, to try to break through educationally and in solidarity with the young people. I cannot imagine young kids, I mean, and I'm almost 70 years old, so I'm saying young kids, and I mean people who are in their 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
Yeah, right there. I see you. I'm looking
I'm still a kid, yeah.
But what I'm getting at is that it's kind of up to us to try to re-educate, and it hurts. Because, yeah, it's difficult being the brunt or feeling the brunt of a bias that's generational or even gender-based. You know, or especially racial or ethnically based, you know, it hurts. And as an old white guy, you know, I get that a lot, but I kind of have to, you know, suck it up a little bit because they're entirely correct. Many, many, many of my peers from my generation did screw things up and it has to be undone.
And yet, you cannot be accurate when you're painting entire populations with one brush.
That's true.
Thank you. It's like how sometimes people who vote Democrat in more northern progressive states talk crap about the South and say, oh, they're a lost cause.
Yeah.
They're just the cesspool of the country. And it's like, that's where the largest populations of people of color live.
Mm-hmm.
That's still where a lot of LGBT people have to live because of economic restrictions. Like, those people still matter.
It's the lowest union density. It's the one that's most oppressed. The working class is separated by race and is separated by generation. And it's a tactic of capitalism.
But I actually wanted to touch on really quickly what you were talking about. This expectation that I think a lot of younger people were kind of fed by their parents of, if you can go to college or if you can get these technical certifications, this is your $45,000 to $120,000 ticket right into the middle class once you pay off those loans, so to speak. I definitely grew up in a home with that kind of expectation. My parents definitely paid off in terms, well, they definitely had the opportunities at that time. My dad getting his college degree. Of course, he was a crab fisherman for 8 years, and my mom working her way up through medicine and eventually into the business world. They definitely kind of gave my brother and I that kind of expectation of, well, if you go to school and you get these degrees.
Because it worked for them.
Because it worked for them.
And did you ever see The Graduate?
Yeah.
Do you remember that line when he graduates and the guy comes up to him at the party and wants to give him this really important key thing that's going to help him to success? And he just looks at him and says, plastics.
Plastics.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what happened with our parents. They said it worked for them.
Right.
You know? And so they're giving what they think is their best advice, but it doesn't work necessarily anymore. Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, there are more college graduates in this country now more than ever. So what used to be this very exclusive thing of only 10 to 15% of the country has this, this will really get you somewhere. Now
that's
it's like...
You've got to get your master's and your doctorate.
40, yeah. Close to 50% of young people, predominantly women, actually. It's mostly that's women that are getting college degrees nowadays, are getting these degrees and they're trying to enter a workforce where it's saturated. And in my own experience, I wanted to go into... quote-unquote entry-level environmental science field. And I mean, I've been applying for jobs for the past 5 years since graduation. And yeah, there were definitely some points where I definitely took a lull in, you know, sending out application after application after application.
Right.
And I definitely suffered from a period of burnout where I was just kind of like, I can either keep trying to market myself on this particular piece of paper, or I can go over to the city of Tacoma, I can go join street operations fresh out of college and get paid $20 an hour for putting hot oil in the cracks in the road.
Mm-hmm.
That one is more appealing when suddenly you're staring down the barrel of rent, buying your own groceries, and paying for your car insurance.
And student loans.
Thankfully, I did not have to deal with that. I had enough financial privilege in my family not to have to deal with that. And I have to say, I am very grateful, very thankful, and very lucky. But you can imagine the massive people, close to, I think, $1 trillion worth of student loan debt that we have in this country right now, that is gaining interest. Yes?
Back in my day, I finished UW at 1969, and it was just a few hundred dollars a year tuition. And my parents were lucky enough to, my dad just had a gas station, you know, my mom didn't work, but back then you could do it because housing costs were low and all that. And so there was no debt accumulated by my sisters or my educations. But so different now that everybody's found that it's super, you know, lucrative to charge a whole lot to students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's capitalism at its finest. Let's wring the dollars out of every last thing.
Yep. Universities are predominantly private institutions, save for the ones that are public, where you, yes, still do pay tuition and you still can accrue loans. But by and large, education operates as a business. Mm-hmm. The college level education operates as a business. And this isn't me sending a message out on the airwaves of, don't get an education. That is the opposite of what I am saying. What I'm saying is more people need an education, but there needs to be some honest opportunities for people that are getting that education. There actually has to be a payoff to getting a degree besides $120,000 of student loan debt.
I have a quick point, which is in the California school system, Berkeley, apparently it's a great institution. It used to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we have the internet and we have Silicon Valley.
And several elements on the periodic table. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah. but as I was saying before, whenever I hear, especially when you're listening to like Bloomberg or Newsweek or CNN or God forbid you listen to Newsmax, the Fox News of Fox News. But when we talk about intergenerational conflict, I think the one thing I keep coming back to is this really a conflict over generations and what opportunities were provided? Which, again, I do think is true. But I think a lot of the quote-unquote resentment that is actually being conversed is not actually between younger people and older people. It's become this... It has gained a life of its own as a separate media narrative of, let's frame this as an intergenerational conflict between different eras of American history and opportunity versus a more... in my opinion, accurate reality of both baby boomers and millennials and Zoomers are getting exploited by these capitalists in a very different way. compared to how they used to. We talk about this with union busting. They used to murder union organizers. Now they can't get away with it. So now they just harass them in one-on-one meetings, or they find a reason to fire them, or they close down entire departments, or sometimes even entire businesses just say, screw it, we'll pack bags and move somewhere else. Right. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, interjection here. Let's remember Judy Berry.
That's right.
IWW, Earth First Organizer, Save the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. Someone tried to kill her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's not current history to a lot of people.
Fair. But I think the bigger picture here is...
they still tried to kill her.
Should we be focusing on an intergenerational, quote-unquote, conflict, or should we be focusing on economic class friction?
I think you raise a really good point. And one of the things that I'm astonished with, which is just an aside here, but I just feel like I have to mention it, cell phones. We gained, quote, such freedom, and it took away our ability to close the door at work and go home. We became on call 24/7.
Yeah.
We no longer had a private life.
It's an electronic leash.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely changed, not just only how work operates, you know. God knows I've watched my dad do hours and hours of homework at home on his laptop or at his desktop after he clocked off. Exactly. But also in terms of things like surveillance, how it makes it more difficult to try to organize. And I think in a unique way, relevant to this conversation, how much this conversation about intergenerational conflict has been amplified. We all know social media is a nightmare. It amplifies, I think, the wrong things in many places. And I think its potential for good in talking about what we talk about is very limited and very self-selected.
Well, as an Ulster, I finished University of Washington in 1975. And I believe that the price was a few hundred dollars a year. And each credit was like $26 or something like that. The books were a lot more expensive than the classes. I remember that very clearly, like three times as much. But anyway, so my parents, who paid for it, partly because of my dad's World War II pension, which mom socked away, there was no debt when I finished, and it's just so totally different now. I can't even imagine having, you know, just to get a basic, what you're supposed to need, what you're supposed to get ahead with. And then you got this huge debt and you can't find work in your field. And I mean, that's hitting millions of people. There's jobs, but for like $15 an hour. And it's got to be just incredibly, it's a problem for our country, billions of dollars worth of, they're not spending. It's, I do feel grateful that I came from a time when it was reasonable to go to the university.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's real, it's way back. Talking about people don't want to work anymore. I found this on my phone. Historically, that's people have always said that. I saw reproductions of newspaper articles from the 1800s, the early 1900s, but nobody wants to work anymore. Some grumpies have always said that. And when you consider the conditions of your labor, why put up with that nonsense?
Yeah.
If you're being abused, disrespected, and underpaid.
Yeah, why should younger workers have quote-unquote loyalty to their employers when their employers show them absolutely no reward and no loyalty themselves? Yeah, it's a two-way street.
Here's another thing about what Gordon said. The Wobblies work to rule. You just, well, I think workers know how to do their jobs. Probably far better than management does when it comes to getting things done on time or early. But if you don't follow the rules and you do what you've learned how to do best, things go a lot better. And if you decide to consciously withdraw your efficiency, things slow way down instead of the profit. So that was like striking on the job. You don't leave. You just slow down. Last comment for me for now is, it's a mathematics game. Figure this out. Two folks graduate from high school. One person goes to college. 4 years later, got a lot of debt and they're looking for a job. The other person joined a union apprentice program.
Yes.
Took a year or so to get trained. You're now working at a union job for 3 years as opposed to the 4 years that you're not making any income at all.
Minimal.
And who comes out ahead?
Well, you have to look at a whole lifetime, though.
Yeah.
Well,
still, if you get a jump on that, if you don't owe any debt, I took an apprenticeship for the machine trade through the U.S. government and through the union, the machinists union, and it was 4 years. And you don't find that anymore. They paid me to go to school, and then they also paid me when I was on the waterfront. Mm-hmm. So and I got the equivalent of an associate's degree education out of it, and that's what my grandkids are doing right now, and it was what my son did. But that's such a little island of job opportunity. You know, the shipyard in Bremerton's a big industrial facility, and they tried to hollow it out. They might have succeeded by contracting out, right? Getting rid of their career government employees. But what I'm getting at is that the apprenticeship allowed a person to go to work and go to school and have a good career. So, and they should bring that back. The union's got to step up their game.
Absolutely.
One more comment and I'll stop. I went to college, studied philosophy to avoid military service in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That was it. Basically, I didn't want to go to school, but I did. And when that was over, went to work in a factory making doors and plywood at a union job. My philosophy degree wouldn't get me anything.
Right.
Well, what's it about a large pizza versus a degree in philosophy? A large pizza can feed a family of four.
Yeah.
and a couple things I wanted to say, but I wanted to go back to what Lynn was talking about, because I went back to school after my husband and I split up and I had two little kids to support. And I went to a community college, Green River Community College, and I was able back then, and that was in the 80s, to get a degree, a two-year degree, with a Pell Grant and a work-study program and support my kids, which I did do. I mean, I did end up having to work for Burger King for approximately one day before I got a job with community mental health in the OT field. But then later, I decided to go back to school after I got laid off after 24 years in community mental health. And I got a degree in 2012. That's another degree, which I got at Evergreen Tacoma. And a majority of the students there were older people returning to work and immigrants. And that time, I had to get a loan. And it took me many years to pay off that loan, even in a Tacoma Evergreen situation. What I wanted to bring the conversation back to, though, because we were talking about the split that's been manufactured to some degree between young workers and older workers. And what we need to take a look at, and what people are taking a look at, is what each generation can offer to help the movement work.
And I think that would be a great place for the conversation to keep going. Absolutely. Yeah. Because,
and so what I see and what I hear, and what many of us older people agree on, is that young people have the energy and the passion, and that's so important to get the work done. And it seems to me, and I'm sure people have things that they can add here, that what old people, us oldsters, have to offer is we have the knowledge that these are ongoing struggles that take a while to achieve. And we've got experience in what has and hasn't worked that may or may not be relevant now.
Mm-hmm.
So like what we said about plastics, you know, that what was valid back in our day may not still be valid, but we do have those struggles and those memories that we can call up. And if young people find it relevant, we have that to offer. And the other thing we have to offer, and I loved it, Bernice Reagan from Sweet Honey in the Rocks said this.
Mm-hmm.
She said, if you're in this struggle and you're doing what you're meant to be doing, you just do the work. And you're putting your life on the line sometimes. And she was talking about civil rights. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing what you're meant to be doing, you don't worry about dying, because that's somebody else's job. If somebody's going to kill you, they're going to kill you.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH.
But what the old people offered during that movement was that they could offer safety.
Absolutely.
They could offer advice for safety, which maybe helped people survive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what other people think about that. What do old people have to offer?
Well, experience, I know it's a cliche, but it's true. Just the normal getting around of everyday problems, a lot of the younger folks are not trained in today. They're not trained in civics. They're not trained in economics. I mean, practical economics, like how to balance a checkbook. Things like that. Plus, dying skills, disappearing skills. Industrial trades have been de-emphasized. Now it's mostly information work or the movement of goods and services. And so there is no practical basis. Yeah, sure, maybe Grandpa still works out in the garage on a wood project. But just the everyday tools of physical work are no longer existent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we could offer that. Also, young people, we're not bragging on ourselves and we're not trying to make you feel bad. What we're saying is that, look, we had these advantages. We no longer do. We should get to work on getting those powers and those advantages back.
Yeah.
For you guys.
There's a unity of purpose there, I think, that's definitely being overlooked.
I think Lynn had her hand up.
Well, there's another thing that oldsters can offer, and people all along the chain of age, but that's not for everyone, but time is something that many that are retired...
good point.
It's not that retired people aren't busy, because believe me, all the retired people I know, including myself, are plenty busy, but that's something that sometimes can be made available, that younger people don't have as much of a luxury of time.
Yeah.
And hopefully... we can contribute money to their campaigns and their struggles.
Please give me money.
I think
please,
we'll
I'm
end
broke.
I think we'll end the discussion on that point.
Absolutely. I think that this is a really good discussion that we've had, and I would love to continue this, hopefully, in an episode in the future, in the near future, because I think that we could talk entirely about what both... younger generations and older generations can offer each other in terms of whether it's organizing experience on the job, whether it's having to deal with the economic hardships of the time, whether it's settling things that work and don't work in terms of our life experience and the lessons learned.
We want to be allies.
Yeah. We are peeling away the layers of this onion here. Unfortunately, the kitchen doesn't have enough time, but we do want to continue this discussion in the future. And thank you so much for all of your input. Moving on to our next section here, we are going to be jumping into our environment report, talking a little bit about the Nalley Valley warehouse update, but also criminal justice as well.
I want to do a couple of updates on environmental unionism, though.
Mm-hmm.
That there are two local issues that are going on that are of interest. Number one, the conflict, I'm going to say conflict, that's been created with the city's plans to allow a mega warehouse,
mm-hmm.
Parking lot on top of an aquifer in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
There will be another gathering and another opportunity to raise your concerns about paving over an aquifer. Since we're in a climate crisis and the city has declared it a climate crisis, why are they paving over an aquifer? And do we need another giant warehouse? It's the Payne Field location, the little airport in South Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to pave that over and put a giant warehouse in that area. There is another opportunity for the city to hear what you think about that on July 11th.
Okay.
So that would be at 5:30 at City Council, 747
Market. I think.
Market, yes. That's the location. So I'm letting people know it's very important if you feel that all of that extra traffic that would be created by the trucks in an area that already has a worse health outcome because there's so much pollution in that area.
And the aquifer. I mean, that's just a hideous.
Well, come down to city council and let them know. And, of course, the other issue has to do with Tacoma Housing for All. And we did get enough signatures.
So that initiative is going to be on the city ballot coming
up. It is, but the city is putting up not a competing, but another ballot measure that addresses that.
You mean the landlord ballot measure?
Well, it's not actually a landlord ballot
measure. Really?
Anyhow, it's a weaker measure. So, yes, it's nice that they're making some, I don't want to say concessions, but some small steps toward fairness, toward reasonable rent. But their ballot measure does not include two of the very important things that Tacoma for All has in it. And those two measures are, during the school year, Tacoma teachers cannot be evicted due to a rent increase during the school year. And Tacoma students cannot be evicted because of a rent increase during the school year. Now, if there's violations of, like, other stuff about being a renter, that's another thing. That's called just cause. Mm-hmm. If there's just cause things, it's not about that. It's about simple rent increases. Because our rents have gone up more than 47% in the last couple years.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And it's putting people unable to pay rent in Tacoma so that teachers and students can't stay in Tacoma. Mm-hmm. And we need to protect that population. So those are those two things. But I also wanted to talk about the Montana Trail derailment. And this is from Common Dreams. Montana trail derailment raises fears of similar disasters on proposed, I can't pronounce it, it's UINTA.
Uinta.
Uinta Basin Railroad. So we've had a number of derailments lately. This one did not actually put the sulfur and the asphalt into the Yellowstone River. But it could have. They were carrying oil. Mm-hmm. So another oil-carrying train.
I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, and this is on top of previous ones that we know about, the ones in Ohio. So this is going on. And what are they doing about it? So I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the listener because we are still looking at potential strikes with the railroad workers union because they did not get what they needed when the Biden administration shut down their proposed strike.
Right. And a lot of their concerns were related to not just the work environment, but also the environmental impacts of things like train derailments, poor infrastructure, maintenance, things like that.
If you're so tired that you fall asleep at the job because you haven't had sufficient time off, if you're so exhausted that you get sick and you're the only person that's running the train, and you're carrying dangerous cargo, the risk for your injury and other people's injuries if it derails is high.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to keep that in people's minds. Please stay aware of that and stay up to date on that.
And may I say that a lot of the listeners might think, oh, that would never happen, one person running the train.
Oh, yeah.
That's what the owners of these private train companies want, one person.
And please be aware that here in Tacoma, we have those same two-mile-long trains, and they are carrying very dangerous cargo. I have cataloged the cargo that they're carrying, and it's a toxic sludge of chemicals and oil and God knows what, going right through our tide flats and right on the Puget Sound, right through a population center.
Those big black tank cars that you see.
Yeah.
Those are the oil trains that we're talking about. And
yeah,
if you just look out your window when you're driving somewhere and near a railroad and you see those big black tank cars, that's what's probably in them.
Yeah. So, on a better note, because I like to end things on some positive information, this is from a magazine that I get, which I enjoy, called Nature's Voice. And the article is, and it's, what was the date on this? This is summer of 2023. People power. Community took on a dirty coal power plant and won. A landmark court settlement is being hailed as a model for transforming communities that have long borne the brunt of pollution from the fossil fuel industry as we transition to a healthier, clean energy future. For years, the aging E.D. Edwards coal-fired power plant near Peoria, Illinois, had routinely violated federal pollution limits, belching unhealthy levels of fine particulate matter, aka soot, into the air and taking a terrible toll, contributing to premature deaths, heart attack, asthma attacks, blah, 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 you know. Local residents organized and partnering with the NRDC, that's the National Resource
Defense Council.
Defense Council, thank you, filed suit under the Clean Air Act. It took 6 years of litigation, but persistence paid off. Not only did the plant's owners agree to shutter it, but the company paid $8.6 million into a settlement fund for community-based projects. So, it can seem like just getting the plant shut down would be a big, great victory for the community, and it is, said NRDC Senior Attorney Jared Knickley, who was one of the lead litigators in the case. But we also want to make sure that communities like Peoria aren't left high and dry, whether we're talking about dealing with the lingering health impacts from pollution, helping displaced workers transition, or redressing longstanding inequities. As residents rang in 2023 by celebrating the closure of the plant, grants from the settlement fund were already being put to good use. And it goes on to say what they all are, but I won't tell you all that because I just wanted to make that a snapshot. And the other thing I wanted to do, I get a little magazine from Backbone Campaign. Are you all aware of that?
No, go ahead.
Okay, the Backbone Campaign started as an organization working to put the backbone back into the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And they started with a visual image that had the platform planks, which are lovely in writing, but very seldom get adopted, on each of the vertebrae in the backbone. But they have been going for at least 20 years now. And I've worked with them in Washington, D.C. and in Denver and different places. Well, they have a project that they call Solutionary Rail. And what they've been working on is getting all of the trains electrified and a grid organized to take a lot of the pollution off the highway and electrify the trains. So they're calling it the Amtrak Cascades Long Range Plan. And it's an that's what they've been working on. And this is all very local. They're in Vashon Island. In July, they'll be joining labor allies to make the case to the U.S. Senate that electrification of rail yards is a first and essential step to harnessing rail as a climate solution. In January, we are bringing together labor, environmental justice, climate, anti-monopoly, and other allies to produce a solutionary rail symposium in Washington, D.C. So if you don't know who the Backbone Campaign is, Google it and give them some love and maybe some support, because this is important. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say on the environment. But on the issue of what we call IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, the local branch of the IWW here in Tacoma has a committee called IWOC. And what we are doing is giving our support to incarcerated workers to help them direct their concerns. So one of the things that I had seen, and a fellow worker, Alan, had emailed me this, What I had was an article from, I believe, The Nation, and also another one that talked about incarcerated workers dying from heat-related causes during this current heat dome in our climate crisis. And I'm going to find that for you because it's an interesting article and you should get a chance to hear it.
Amplifying on that, it's interesting to note that the legislature of Texas and the governor of Texas has just revoked rules for allowing people to take water breaks in Texas.
Yeah, we're going there.
Okay.
This is in Truth Out. So hang on, listener. I'm so sorry I made you wait. Okay, this is from Truth Out. And it says, in brutal summer heat, prisoners say their cells are like stifling hot coffins. Days of extreme heat without access to enough water and cooled air become deadlier for an aging prison population. And this is July 3rd, 2023, by Victoria Law. Good name, Victoria. So, shortly after midnight this past Friday, guards found 37-year-old Elizabeth Haggerty dead in her unair-conditioned Texas prison. The day before, the temperatures had reached nearly 100 degrees. I'm going to stop here for a second. Last Thursday was the hottest day in recorded history, planet-wide.
Mm-hmm. On average, right?
Yeah. Haggerty was scheduled for parole on August 2nd. She almost made it. She had been sentenced to 4 years in prison for not meeting the many requirements of her 10-year probation sentence for a fight with an ex-girlfriend. Her mother-in-law, Martha Romero, told Truth Out that Haggerty had diabetes, asthma, and high blood pressure, but was otherwise healthy. In mid-June, Haggerty was transferred from an air-conditioned prison to the Dr. Lane Murray unit. 10 days later, she told Romero that she was feeling sick, couldn't keep food down, and had lost 12 pounds over the last week. 2 days later, she was dead. This past June, 32 people died in Texas state prisons. During the last week of June, 3 people, including Haggerty, died in Texas prisons that lacked air conditioning. All were in their 30s.
Oh.
35-year-old Tommy McCullough died while mowing the grass at the Thomas Gorey unit in Huntsville. His family told KXAN that he had been complaining about excessive heat and insufficient access to water all week. Romero called the prison, but the family had no answer. We won't find out till the autopsy, Romero said. Even then, they're not going to say. It was so hot that her heart was working. Was so hot that her heart was working hard, and her blood pressure went up. They'll never use heat as a cause. While the Texas Department of Criminal Justice has not reported a heat-related death since 2012, think of that. A study found that extreme heat was likely behind 271 summer deaths between 2001 and 2019. As climate change increases, temperatures, jails, and prisons become summer hotboxes. The New York Times has predicted that at least one of the next 5 years will exceed 2016 temperatures, which was the planet's hottest year. Even if it doesn't top 2016, this summer is expected to be hotter than average across the U.S., and that means more heat-related illness and more heat-related deaths. Here's another one, briefly. I have become one with my sweat. This is Roderick Zavala. He's incarcerated at the Menard Correctional Center on the banks of the Mississippi River. So it's not just Texas where they're dying. Opened in 1878, the prison currently incarcerates nearly 2,200 men. He's one of many Illinois prisoners. It's one of many Illinois prisons that lack effective cooling systems. No air gets in and no air escapes. The windows open only 6 inches, but their screens are caked with years of debris, dirt, and sludge, forming another barrier to any breeze that might blow in. Many of the 15 fans along the corridor of his housing unit are broken. Those that work have not been cleaned in years, creating cyclones of dirt, dust, and dander. When COVID came, weeks and months of lockdown happened. Confined in their cells, incarcerated people were unable to seek slightly cooler temperatures outside or access even the 8-ounce cup of ice normally allocated to each person once a day. IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. We have been in touch here, our IWW branch, with Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, and they have given us what it is they want. And we would love to present that in Tacoma in the form of a town hall and work with other groups as allies to get these issues addressed. I've reached out to several members of the Black Panthers and to Democratic Socialists in Tacoma. And stay tuned if you want to hear more about what we're trying to do for humane working conditions for prisoners. Just because you broke the law doesn't mean you have to die.
Absolutely.
Or if you're one of the estimated 2 to 10% who've been falsely convicted.
There's that.
Who've been sent to prison because your lawyer is incompetent. And by the way, there was a case that settled this. A man was convicted of a crime, and he appealed based on the fact that his lawyer was drunk and fell asleep at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge said, "Hey, we didn't promise you a good lawyer. We just promised you a lawyer."
Yeah.
And this man's doing,
significant time.
So in terms of heat-related illness and death, this summer we have seen UPS workers, we have seen Amazon workers, and mail carriers die because they haven't been given what they need to survive their working conditions in the heat.
Don't forget our agricultural and farm workers.
Absolutely, you're right. Yeah. And Texas has just seen fit to roll back the few protections that workers had, such as 10-minute breaks and water breaks.
That's just spite. It's the only thing I could think of. There's no logical reason for that except hatred.
Because they can.
Then I've got one more comment about Texas.
Yeah.
Tejas. Prisoners, somebody filed suit against the state of Texas to insist that the prisons be air conditioned.
Yeah. Oh, it's on the books.
Yeah. The estimate was about $4 million to retrofit the prisons, and the state of Texas spent $7 million
fighting it
to prevent that.
Yeah.
So that's a balance of human suffering. That do we know who to blame? I do.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean you have to be powerless entirely. So please organize, ally with your community, keep abreast of the news in Tacoma as far as the town hall that we would like to present for incarcerated workers. Please come down to County City Building on July 11th and speak up about the proposal to pave over our aquifer and spew pollution in an already burdened neighborhood. Please support Tacoma for All's ballot initiative.
Home in Tacoma for All. Yeah.
Thank you. Home in Tacoma for All's ballot initiative, the 10-point plan to protect tenant rights. And keep working. Mm-hmm. Keep working for justice.
Absolutely. Coming to the end of our show here, a couple other announcements I'd also like to throw out there. We have a concert coming up in Centralia for David Rovix, as well as a couple other performers coming up.
Well,
do you have a TBD on that?
The concert includes David Rovix,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad to hear that he's coming up here. But the occasion for the concert is that there was a mini Kristallnacht down in Centralia when they were having a pride festival.
Yes.
And windows were broken by
Nazis.
By Nazis, basically. And Mike and Mary Garrison of the Centralia IWW are having a concert in support of LGBTQI rights. And because they are not afraid.
Absolutely. Do we have a date and time for that?
That's July 23rd, and I believe it's at 5:30 till 8, but I'm not quite certain on that. Mm-hmm. But I can post something.
Yeah, we can post it to the...
Okay.
WOB Radio has a Facebook page, fellow listeners. Feel free to follow us at WOB Radio on Facebook. We post local community events, ongoing organizing, and strikes that are taking place both here locally and abroad, as well as some of the articles that we talk about in terms of our labor news in this radio show. So, also, fellow listeners, as part of our radio broadcasting, I am part of KTQA. Maryland's part of KTAH. KTQA is currently doing a historical Tacoma podcast series on the radio. And one of the recent episodes we've discovered is actually a series of interviews from 1975. And one of the people interviewed was actually reminiscing about IWW activity in the city of Tacoma during the 1910s and 20s.
This has always been a labor town.
Absolutely. And we hope to produce that not only through KTQA, but we'll be bringing that to WOB Radio as an independent broadcast in the future. So stay tuned for that on our Facebook page.
And I found the event.
Go ahead.
So if this can get up on the air in time, which it may not be, tomorrow, which would be July 9th, the Tacoma Democratic Socialists of America have their barbecue and potluck, and it's going to be at Lincoln Park, and it's at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And people are invited to come learn more about Democratic Socialists. And if it sounds like something you'd like to be involved with or lend support to, you will be welcomed.
Thank you for that. Wrapping up the show here, we just want to thank you so much to our listeners who are currently tuning in. This has been a broadcast of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. And you can hear us at KTAH 101.9 FM Radio Tacoma, KTQA 95.3 FM out of Hilltop, Tacoma, and KZAX 94.9 FM out of downtown Bellingham. All of our schedules are posted online at all of three of those radio broadcasters, as well as our Facebook page. We want to thank you again for supporting a union-made and union-focused radio show, and we hope that you tune in again in the future. Solidarity.
Solidarity forever.
Solidarity.
Solidarity.